Friends of Jesus Christ, let me, before getting into the sermon itself, let me give you a context for this passage. Really, this passage begins back in verse 32, where Jesus says to his disciples that they will take the road up to Jerusalem to celebrate Passover. And he then tells them that in Jerusalem, he, the Son of Man, will be arrested, charged, sentenced to death, handed over to the Gentiles, spit on, flogged, and then killed. But on the third day, he'll rise again. And then you'll remember, and we looked at this last week, James and John missed the whole point and asked Jesus if they could have prominent seats in the kingdom that he's to establish. So now, they've been progressing, and they are in Jericho. Now, Jericho is 5 miles west of the Jordan River and about 18 miles northeast of Jerusalem. And it's mostly uphill. It's mountainous terrain and oftentimes very dangerous. But because it was crowded with pilgrims, the danger had been, of course, lessened. Anyway, they come to Jericho and they meet Bartimaeus. Now, it says Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus. But, of course, Bar is the Hebrew son. So it's simply son of Timaeus, son of Timaeus. But it was for the Greek readers who wouldn't know, or English readers or Korean readers, whatever. But anyway, Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus. And it's important, I think, that his name is mentioned because it indicates, because usually they don't mention the names of those who are healed, but here it does, and it probably indicates that the early church was familiar with the son of Timaeus. They knew him. That's the context. Now the whole passage, this passage, it strikes me that it is all about seeing. And as I was reflecting on seeing, I remembered in the book by Annie Dillard, A Pilgrim at Tinker's Creek. She has a chapter on seeing. And in the chapter, she has a number of pages about people who were born blind because of cataracts and then, due to surgery, were unable to see. And then the book describes reactions to this seeing. And some are dazzled and others are terrified and they refuse to see anymore. They want to be blind again. But there is one response that has always moved me. Annie Dillard describes her as a 22-year-old girl. She was dazzled by the world's brightness and then kept her eyes shut for 2 weeks. When at the end of that time she opened her eyes again, she did not recognize any objects, but the more she now directed her gaze upon everything about her, the more it could be seen how an expression of gratification and astonishment overspread her features. And she repeatedly exclaimed, "Oh my God, how beautiful! Oh my God, how beautiful!" It is a seeing that I think we all long for. Not to be blasé, not to be bored, but to be astonished by the beauty and the goodness that is all around us. Seeing. Did you know that there was a philosopher several generations before Plato who was asked, what did he think men and women were born for? And he said that we are born for seeing. We are born for seeing. And then a 20th century theologian, Pierre de Chardin, in his book, he has this grand picture of the universe, and he says that the whole purpose of the cosmos' evolution is the elaboration of ever more perfect eyes. The elaboration of ever more perfect eyes. Now here's a thing that's not simply physical, though that's wondrous enough. That this sees more deeply. This sees more grandly, it seems to me. You know, there's a phrase that I think all of us have heard. The beatific vision, right? I think in Latin it's visio beatifica. But it's a seeing. Here's how one describes it. It's a seeing that confers bliss. A seeing that confers bliss. And there's a whole school of thought in the Christian tradition that says that the whole purpose of our being, the end of all of life, is this beatific vision that culminates in you and me seeing God face to face. A seeing that confers bliss. And we don't have to wait till the end of history. There is a seeing even today that sees the goodness and the kindness of God in the faces of the people around us, in the wonders of creation, and especially, I think, in the glory that we see in the face of Jesus Christ as we meet him in the scriptures. This is a seeing that confers bliss. You know, the Apostle Paul in Ephesians writes to the Ephesians that he prays for them. You know what he prays? Well, he prays. He says, I pray to the God of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of glory, that as you come to know him, he will give you a spirit of wisdom and revelation so that the eyes of your heart are illumined, are enlightened. The eyes of your heart enlightened so that you may know or see the hope to which you've been called, the wondrous of being part of the inheritance of God, and the power that is available to you. So to have the eyes of our hearts enlightened or illumined so that we may see the hope to which we've been called and the power that is working on our behalf. It is such wondrous seeing. And when you think about that, when I thought about that, I thought, you know, in a way, we're all more or less blind, nearsighted, farsighted, struggling with cataracts. And we're all crying, no matter how different we are. We're all saying, oh, Lord, open my eyes and let me see. Let me see truly. And so I see ourselves sitting there right next to Bartimaeus. But Bartimaeus sits there begging. It's the only way he can make a living in the ancient world, as a blind man, apparently. And he gets wind that among all of the pilgrims moving towards Jerusalem, there is Jesus of Nazareth. And so Bartimaeus shouts out or cries out, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. And then when everybody around him tells him to shut his mouth, he cries all the louder, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. Now, all of that has great significance. First of all, that cries out. Do you know that in the Gospel of Mark, that is used almost always when someone recognizes the transcendence of Jesus? In fact, in the first chapter already, there's an evil spirit that says, oh, Jesus, son of God, son of David, what do you want with us? But now here is Bartimaeus crying out, Jesus, son of David. Now, you know, it's not at all revealed to us why or how Bartimaeus knew that this Jesus of Nazareth, this no account town, how this Jesus was the son of David. But he calls him Jesus, son of David. And that really, in Jewish circles at the time of the first century, was simply another way of saying Messiah, the anointed one of God. Bartimaeus exclaimed that this Jesus is the Messiah that comes from the house of David, who would sit on the throne of a kingdom that would establish peace and shalom. Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. Now, you know, that cry for mercy, it is very near the heart of Christian worship. Have mercy on me. I mean, we say, Kyrie eleison. I mean, Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. Oftentimes in the Psalms, it is a cry directed to God to have mercy on us who are afflicted and troubled and broken. And now Bartimaeus directs this cry to Jesus as if to say that this healing, this mercy must come to him through the Messiah, through the Christ. mercy. You know, we say sometimes he threw himself on the mercy of the court. Mercy implies both a request for forbearance and for kindness. Forbearance and for kindness. You know, I long ago read a novel by Carol Shields entitled The Stone Diaries. And she has a reference to mercy that I want to share with you because it may have the same impact on you as it did on me. The story, among other characters in the story, there's a Giler Goodwill. And he is a stonecutter, a rather well-known stonecutter. And when he retires, he decides that he will build the Great Pyramid to scale in his backyard. It will require 2 million small pieces of stone. And at one point, he's 10 years into the project, and the pyramid is only a quarter finished. And he's in his backyard, and he notices that the thing is off-center, and that the more he builds on it, the more unseemly it will appear. And just then, he has this heart attack, and he falls backward, and he can't move. But through his feet are sort of spread, he can see this thing, this pyramid that he spent his last 10 years on, and he's thinking, why did I do that? Why didn't I just take a cruise? You know, he's getting upset with himself, and he thinks he should have gotten rid of it. He's very upset. But he can't move, and he begins to think, and he remembers that his wife had left for the day, and that she wouldn't come back till late in the evening. And he has all these reminiscences, and then he remembers he remembers that he put this box at the base of the pyramid, and that in the box he had put, among other things, the wedding ring of his first wife, who had died in childbirth. And he can't think of her name. And so he goes down the alphabet, A with, you know, Amy, Abigail. He goes all the way down, and all the while he's also thinking of other things. And then he comes, and it's now evening, and he knows now that he is dying. He suddenly remembers that the name of his first wife, who would stand at the door waiting for him as he came home, her name was Mercy. Ah, Mercy, hold me in your soft arms. Cover me with your body. Oh, Mercy, keep me warm. And, you know, that is such a wonderful, to me, you know, it's such a wonderful expression of mercy. We are broken. Have mercy on me and mend me. I am sad. Have mercy on me and comfort me. I am alone. I'm dying. Have mercy on me. Have mercy on me. Envelop me in your arms. Cover me with your body. Keep me warm. Mercy. All of us long for mercy. And so Bartimaeus cries out, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And then Jesus acts so royally here. It's really quite remarkable. He acts like he is a king already. He stops and he says, call him here. And they called the blind man, saying to him, take heart, get up, he is calling you. So the very same people who had just moments ago told him to keep his mouth shut are now saying, you know, take heart, he wants you, get going. And then we read, so throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. Now, it wasn't until this week that I saw the significance of this throwing off his cloak, because in one of the commentaries I read, I was told that a blind man oftentimes would use the cloak to cover his lap, so that when people threw their coins his way, they would fall into his lap. A small container would oftentimes be missed, and to throw the coins on the ground, a blind man couldn't find them. So he had this cloak that became kind of like a large pouch for him. And for Bartimaeus to throw off this cloak and spring to his feet and come to Jesus was, in a sense, throwing off the tool of his trade. And this commentator makes this wonderful suggestion that perhaps what we have here is another call to discipleship. Because just as in the beginning of the gospel, Jesus sees John and James and Peter fishing, and he says, come follow me, and they turn their backs on their nets and follow Jesus. So now Bartimaeus becomes a kind of model, again, of discipleship, where he throws off the cloak, this tool of his trade, springs to his feet, and comes to Jesus. Now, when I mentioned earlier in the week, when I hadn't gotten to that yet, that I was preaching on Bartimaeus, somebody said that they remembered a sermon that their preacher had preached when they were way back there in high school. And it had moved her greatly, she said. And I said, well, what did he say? Well, he specialized. He sort of focused in on this. He threw off his cloak. And sort of secretly to myself, I rolled my eyes thinking, oh, a little moralism. But which is terrible among preachers. But anyway, now I see that he was right on target. Because really part of this is to say, if Bartimaeus had to throw off his cloak and spring to his feet and come to Jesus, what's your cloak? I mean, what do you have to get rid of? What's standing in the way for you to come to Jesus, who becomes for you a channel of mercy? And you know, I don't know what this minister said, and I don't know quite what to say myself, except I know that there are things that you and I need to sometimes get rid of, throw overboard, because they stand in the way. I mean, I was talking to somebody this week who said, you know, what really bugs me about myself is that I can be so obsessing about things, about some mistake that I've made, or some sin that I've committed, or that some loss. I keep obsessing over it so that it's always dark and it's always gnawing at me. And I can never, you know what that obsessing is? It's one of those cloaks that needs to be gotten rid of. Salute it and move on, because it stands in the way of you and me coming to the Christ. Or maybe it's a friendship or a habit. But it's this cloak that strangled you, or that keeps you down. Bartimaeus throws off his cloak, springs to his feet, and comes to Jesus. Then Jesus says to him, what do you want me to do for you? Now, I don't know whether you were here last Sunday, but last Sunday, it's the very same question that Jesus asked of John and James. Remember, John and James, they come, and they say, we want you to do whatever we ask you. And then Jesus says the very same thing. What do you want me to do for you? And then, of course, John and James want to sit on his right and left hand. And Jesus sees them as blind as bats about his mission. And now Bartimaeus comes and he says, my teacher, let me see again. You see, and of course, in Isaiah, the Messiah would in fact be one to restore sight to the blind. And he's not asking just for a good sum of money so that he doesn't need to be begging. He asks what the Messiah has in fact been commissioned to do, to restore sight. And you see, and I'm thinking this. You know, Mark has written this gospel, and we've now come to, well, the next thing that happens after this episode, by the way, is the triumphal entry, the Palm Sunday. So Mark says, I don't care whether you have 20/20 vision. I don't care whether you have 20/20 vision. At this point, you and I must pray that we may have the eyes to see what will occur in the next week, a week that will end in the crucifixion and the resurrection. Mark, as the Gospels in general, continually want us to see, especially the identity of Jesus. Who is this Jesus? May you have the eyes to see the truth about this Jesus, because in seeing the truth about Jesus, you will see the truth about God, you will see the truth about yourself. To see. And so then Jesus says to Bartimaeus, go, your faith has made you well. And immediately he regained his sight and followed him on the way. Go, your faith has made you well. Now I got stuck there. Your faith has made you well. Clearly, Faith itself is not healing. We've all been told that. And no one can really fix his or her own, you know, nearsightedness or farsightedness, or not even the best eye doctor can operate on her own eyes. And so what we understand here is that the healing, of course, comes from Christ, but faith is the medium. Faith is the medium here. And John Calvin defined faith sometimes as a receptacle, an empty receptacle in which the Spirit pours gifts of wisdom and revelation. But some while ago now, again, I was constantly referring to Marilynne Robinson's book, Gilead. Well, there's a reference to this thing that we're discussing here. If you're not familiar with the book, it's really a letter, a long letter, of an old preacher, John Ames, in Iowa, writing to his son, a young boy, maybe 8-10 years old, of his second marriage. And he's writing this letter so that his son may know something about him and his family. And one of the things that you come across in that book is this wonderful seeing. I mean, not just the radiance and splendor of the prairie, but the presence of God. And there's one incident in John Ames' life that has grabbed him. The whole town had gone to this church that had been struck by lightning, and they were tearing it down, and it was raining, and John, as a little boy, is sitting under the wagon, protected from the rain, watching the grown-ups, women and men, doing their thing. And at one point, his father comes with a biscuit, and they kneel together in the rain, and his father, with his ashy hands, puts a piece of biscuit in his mouth and then takes a piece of the biscuit and puts it in his own mouth. And John sees that and experienced that as a moment where he was sitting, kneeling with Christ in Gethsemane, and he was aware. It was just a great moment of transcendence. It's such a good moment. And then here's what he says. He says, "The biscuit, ashy from my father's charred hand, it means all more than I can tell you. So you must not judge what I know by what I find words for." You know, that's a preacher's line. "You must not judge what I know by what I find words for. If I could only give you what my father gave me." No, "what the Lord gave me, and must also give you." And then this line, "But I hope you will put yourself in the way of the gift. I hope you will put yourself in the way of the gift." And I think that's a description of faith. Faith puts us in the way of the gift. And then I think, do we put ourselves in the way of the gift? And I'm thinking, well, yes, of course, we're all here, in a sense, bearing our souls and hoping all together that we may see the truth of Christ, that we may receive the gift. About a week ago, 2 weeks, I was talking to a young woman, early 30s, and she's not a member of this church. And I was saying that I was sort of wondering what I was going to do for a book discussion. I mean, you know, Dale Cooper's got November and December, and then I would do something in January. And I said, you know, at first I was thinking of doing Yancey's book on prayer. Heard lots of good things about it. But, you know, there's this new book coming out by Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion. And now I'm thinking, maybe we should do that book. And she says, "I don't know this Richard Dawkins." Well, I said, "He hates the Christian faith. Just wants to squash it. But I think it might be a good thing for us to sort of look him in the face, hear his complaints and arguments, and then address them." So she said, "I guess that'd be all right." I said, "Well, what would you join? What would you think I should do?" And then she said, "I think you should do Yancey's book." "Oh," I said, "you do?" She says, "Yes." I said, "Well, why?" And then here's what she said, in effect. She says, "Well, I got to tell you, there is enough in my life that unsettles my faith. I don't need to go look for it." You know, I like that answer. There is. I don't think we should avoid the Richard Dawkins of the world, but there is enough. I know there is enough in your life that could unsettle your faith. You see? And I know for myself how there are certain things that can just demoralize me and make me think it's all just a bunch of hocus pocus. And then there are other times when I think, yes, this is it. I'm a little unstable perhaps, but that's how, don't you feel that sometimes? I mean, here's an example. Yancey. This is an email my son sent me of a blog that Yancey wrote. And I don't know whether it's in the book on prayer, but anyway, in the blog, Yancey talks about a book tour that he had taken in South Africa. And while in South Africa, he had met Joanna, a colored woman, which is what they call children of black and white parents. Anyway, this woman, after the apartheid was dismantled, this woman decided to minister in this sort of infamous prison where Mandela had been held for 8 years. And she went there, and she had such remarkable results that the BBC sent a television crew to investigate. And now Yancey meets with her, and they're having lunch or dinner, and Yancey wants to know, what did you do? How did you do this? What do you count for this? And then at one point, this is what Yancey says, and this so cheered me. But anyway, he said I asked her more, and then suddenly Joanna was going to put a fork full of food in her mouth. She stopped and she looked at me and she says, "Well, of course, Philip. God was already in prison. All I had to do was make him visible." And I thought, yes. We need more examples of God being made visible. I think as church, we must make God visible. I think we need to see in the sacraments and in the preaching the glory of Christ. We need to see him visible, and we need to make ourselves available to the gift, put ourselves in the way of the gift, because otherwise I'm afraid we're going to die on the vine in our faith. It is not good when we, as Christians, for instance, take this church membership and life with God if there's some time left over. We need to live to make God visible. With our kindness, with our graciousness, with our readiness to be the servant of grace, with great worship. I mean, you know how that is when you look around and you see people you admire crying for mercy and singing praises. It is so strengthening. It is a way in which we put ourselves in the way of the gift. Jesus says, "Go, your faith has made you well." And immediately he regained his sight and followed him on the way. Now there again, I think Mark means to say, not just that Bartimaeus went with them up to Jerusalem, but the way, the early church was called the people of the way. I see this as a sort of an indirect reference to Bartimaeus becoming a disciple. And here's the whole sermon. It is a seeing that confers bliss and transforms into discipleship. I mean, the two belong together. It is a seeing that confers bliss and transforms into discipleship, or is manifested in discipleship. And so, let us put ourselves in the way of the gift, so that seeing, we may receive bliss, and receiving bliss, be transformed into disciples. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.